You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video on demand content library, free registration for all PSI webinars, and much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician, and this is a special one because I haven't recorded a new episode for quite a while, and I'm today again with one of my favorite guests, Kaspar. Hi Kaspar, how are you doing?
Hi Alexander, thanks for having me again and welcome back. More than happy to be on the podcast again, and very happy to talk with you again.
And we are talking about a topic that is not new, but very relevant because of something that came out of ICH. But we'll talk about that at the end. Adaptive studies, adaptive clinical trials, and especially confirmatory clinical trials. I have never worked actually on one, so I'm super happy to have an expert like Kaspar to talk with me about it. Why do we actually want to adapt clinical trials? So basically change the study, so to say, in the middle of its running.
Yes, I think this is a very good question. Why should we bother? Because there is a risk. It makes the study more challenging to design and also to run. So there needs to be a good justification why we should actually adapt. And the way I see it a little bit, and maybe starting a little bit kind of the history, I think in the 70s, in the 80s, drug developers developed group sequential designs. So this is a design where you have a primary endpoint. You want to run the trial in a confirmatory fashion. That means you want to have type 1 error protection, but you don't want just to run the trial in one stage. To detect a hazard ratio of 0.75 with 80% power and alpha 5%, you need 380 events. One option would just be to wait until you have 380 events. However, maybe you want to look halfway, say after 50% of these 380 events, whether maybe the effect or your hypothesis test already rejects the null, but that you're already statistically significant. When you do that, you look twice after 50% of these events. And then if you don't reject, you will again look at the end, at the final analysis. And the fact that you look twice, you have to correct for. This means, and we all know these group sequential designs, you can then distribute your 5% of alpha differently to the interim and to the final, either saying, I want to have a similar alpha level, that's what we call a Pocock boundary, or distribute it a little bit more unevenly so that you save almost all of the alpha for the final analysis and have a very high hurdle at the interim, that's what we call O'Brien-Fleming, and then there are other boundary functions. So if you think about it, this is an adaptive design because at the interim analysis, you have the choice to either continue the trial as planned or adapt the sample size to zero, which correspond to stopping the trial. Now, people have started to run these trials, I think in the 80s, and then in order to maintain the integrity of the trial, you assemble an IDMC, Independent Data Monitoring Committee, who looks at the data, the interim analysis in our template trial after half of the events. Or maybe they see something. They see, for example, that there is a subpopulation in which the drug works, but not in the full population. And I think on an ad hoc basis, people then started to say, over-enroll in that subpopulation. So they adapted beyond just either stopping the trial or continue as planned. And for a while that went on. And then at some point, people started to think, oh, this actually does not maintain type 1 error anymore. So the theoretical development in statistics caught up and started to develop methods for also more advanced adaptations than just setting the sample size to zero, yes or no. And I let you comment, then maybe we can discuss what adaptations are actually possible and meaningful in a drug development context.
Looking into subgroups is surely a very interesting area, especially if you say it says your treatment effect might be different across different subgroups, or maybe your safety is different across different subgroups. And you want to have that also taken into account. Another topic could be that maybe you can change what's your primary endpoint. What do you think about that one?
So you're jumping the gun a little bit here. Let's say there are two types of adaptations. One type is what is statistically mathematical possible. And I think a subset of that is then what is possible or meaningful in a drug development context. Mm. Changing the endpoint, and we are talking about confirmatory clinical trials, so phase 3 trials. Mm. And changing the endpoint halfway through a phase 3 trial, while mathematically, statistically possible, I think is a challenge in a drug development regulatory context, because I could well put myself in the shoes of a regulator. If a sponsor shows up and says, oh, we want to change the endpoint halfway through, I would ask, are you ready to go into phase 3 if this is your intention? But theoretically, that's possible. But I think there are other adaptations that are more relevant in drug development context. I already described this potential adaptation at an interim analysis to decide on the testing strategy at the final, whether to just test in a subpopulation, in the all comers, or in both. It's quite obvious that this introduces multiplicity and you need to account for that. Yeah. Another, I think the other key adaptation that we have in clinical trials is when you start with a control arm and then maybe say two arms, two different treatments, two different doses of the same treatment, and you want to halfway through drop one of these experimental arms and just continue with the better. But you then, at the final analysis, you want to compare all the data that you have recruited over the entire course of the trial, but you have looked into the data at the interim, so you need to account for that fact that you have dropped an arm. You cannot just take the arm that survived at the interim, compare it to control without making any adjustments. For me, these are two key adaptations: enrichment, treatment arm selection, and then group sequential designs, set the sample size to zero, yes or no. That's another important adaptation. You can also argue that, for example, you want to start with a 1-to-1 randomization ratio. And then if you meet some criteria at the interim, maybe you start to enrich the treatment arm to a 2-to-1. That is also an adaptation. And finally, if you have a continuous endpoint, say a mean difference, you have to specify a variance or to assume a variance at the design stage. Now, if you are wrong with that assumption on the variance, say you assumed the variance to be smaller than what you actually observe at the interim, you might want to inflate the sample size after the interim to account for the fact that you have more variability than what you assumed at the design stage. So this is what we call sample size reassessment. For me, this whole field of adaptive designs, that's about it, what is meaningful in drug development. You can add theoretically more things like change of primary endpoint, theoretically possible. I think I have seen one example where this has been done, but that's not the first thing I would think of when talking about adaptations.
Completely agree. I think it becomes really challenging to understand and interpret and communicate the outcomes of a study where you change your primary endpoint somewhere in the middle. I think the dose selection is also a very interesting case that goes into phase 2, phase 3 seamless design, isn't it?
Now you're touching one of my pet peeves a little bit, because we keep using these terms very often. Seamless, phase two, three. I'm not so supportive of using these terms because I think they can generate a lot of confusion outside of biostatistics because people are not very clear about what it means. But if we leave terminology aside, you can think of it in that way. And in my previous company, there was this template example where this has been pulled off, and that the setup was basically you had an approved drug, a targeted drug, in some indication. And that same molecular target was present in another cancer. Mm-hmm. So this itself to say, we should try that drug in this other cancer as well, of course. But we don't want to rerun the whole development program from the beginning and rehash everything because we have a lot of safety data. We just need to show efficacy in a phase three setup, and we want to do that in an efficient way. Still, because it's a different cancer, we're not sure about the dose. Mm-hmm. So you have an approved drug in one indication, you have the same molecular target in another indication, and you want to directly start phase three with two doses. Mm-hmm. And here, this made a lot of sense. And then you say, okay, let's start with two doses. Let's define an interim decision criteria, which actually in this specific case was based on safety, efficacy, and PK/PD data. So you can define whatever criteria you want. Drop an arm at an interim, and then that arm that makes it to the end, compare that to the control, and that's then my pathway to potential approval. The trial failed. The design was very innovative at the time, very fit for purpose.
You can't judge a trial by trial design by the outcome.
I completely agree with what you say. The value of a design should be independent of whether the drug works or not. The degree of how innovative a design is leads to an efficient decision.
Yeah.
And the point is to make the right decision. Failure of the drug doesn't say anything about the quality of the design, but very often innovative designs sink with the drug if the trial is not successful, and which is very unfortunate. But yeah, this is just things that work.
Yeah. So let's look a little bit into the methodology part. So if we now have, let's make it very simple. We have just the two stages and we test once and then we test later again. What does a methodology look like?
I think this was the big observation of Peter Bauer in, I think, I don't know, the 90s. Because you can, if you say, I run a trial and I want to adapt at an interim analysis halfway through, what you ultimately have is you have a first piece and then you adapt something, say you drop an arm, and then you have a second piece. Ultimately, what you have done is you have two independent studies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is reminiscent of a meta-analysis. So what adaptive designs basically do is they borrow from methods from meta-analysis. And one of these methods is just p-value combination. So you compute the p-value in the first stage, you compute the p-value in the second stage, and then you combine these p-values to give you an overall p-value of the trial of both stages. And under the null, these two p-values are uniformly distributed, and based on that, you can derive a global test statistic. And that's, of course, things are may a little bit get a little bit more tricky, but ultimately, this is how I think about it. So in meta-analysis, you combine inference from separate trials. In an adaptive design, you combine inference from several stages of a trial. And the most prominent, I think, p-value combination function is maybe just to multiply the two p-values and then properly calibrate them such that at the end of the day, you have a valid hypothesis test. You then just need to think about what exactly, what hypothesis do I reject? Mm. So these are these little nitty-gritty details you need to think about. But conceptually, this is what happens.
To sum it up, there's lots of opportunity what we can do. We can create much more efficient designs to make more efficient decisions. And also the methodology is surely not new, although I think there's always some new advances here and there. the framework and lots of these things are really long established and well understood. Why don't we see more of these adaptations?
This is a question that a lot of people ask, and I think quite a few papers have been written about that, kind of making formal polls. Why are these designs not used more often? I don't have a definite answer. Maybe I have a few hints and a few pointers. I think what people sometimes underestimate is when we talk about these adaptations, or sometimes people mistake adaptive designs for, let's start a trial, let's look at the data halfway through, and then think about how we change the trial. This is not how it works. These adaptations, so group sequential enrichment, treatment arm selection, and sample size reassessment, this is all pre-planned at the design stage. You very precisely say what you're going to do, and you have an interim analysis at which you pick one of a couple of a handful of options. And I think this is sometimes underestimated when that, and it is a bit more complicated to implement than just a one-stage design where you can just compute sample size and go with it. So that's one aspect. I think another aspect is it may need a bit more upfront planning. And that trial I was describing with the dose selection in another indication, there internally, the comparison was made. We want to answer this drug development question. We want to get pivotal evidence in a new indication, and we propose an adaptive design with dose selection. An alternative would be to first run a randomized phase two between the two competing doses, finish that, pick the dose that turned out to be better, and run it again to compare against the comparator in yet another phase three. That's much more easy to plan. So say, just, I don't recall the numbers, but say you need 3 months to plan the randomized phase two, and you need 3 months to plan the randomized phase three. That gives you 6 months. If you plan this, what you call the seamless phase two, three adaptive trial, maybe that takes you 12 months. So that's 12 months against 6 months. But the time you save is maybe 1 year with the seamless trial. So you save 6 months at the end. And actually, in this specific case, it was about 1 year. The issue is that very often in companies, teams are incentivized through metrics that don't help. With one of these metrics, for example, is first patient in.
Yeah.
And if teams have to rush to include the first patient, of course, they try not to have a too complicated design. Even if that design would save you 1 year, 2 years until you get approval. So the metric one should actually use is, when is my clinical cutoff date for regulatory, at which I can generate regulatory or pivotal evidence? And I think that this is, in some sense, teams are not incentivized to plan more complicated trials. That's another aspect. I think yet another aspect is hesitancy of decision makers. Because again, if we take these two competing approaches, a seamless phase two, three versus a randomized phase two followed by a randomized phase three. In the randomized phase two scenario, decision makers can look at the data after the randomized phase two and make a decision and still share their opinion and their view and have a say. In a seamless trial, you outsource that decision to an IDMC, basically. Say you save 2 years, but you have to put the money on the table for a phase two. A seamless phase two, three trial is basically a phase three trial. That's why I don't like this seamless phase two, three thing. It's just a pivotal trial. So you have to put the money on the table for a pivotal trial, and you are blinded to what those the IDMC picks, actually the scenario in this trial. And I think this is sometimes challenging for teams to get through governance bodies in companies, because it takes a lot of courage to do it.
I think the other is prior experience in that therapeutic area. And if you can point to a similar drug or a similar study that has run in the same therapeutic area, then it becomes much easier. However, if all of the others have done, let's say, the standard approach, it's even harder to convince, because you can't say, well, the others done it that way. And that's always hard with anything that is innovative. Also, we can't really say adaptive designs are innovative, let's say, you know, 30, 40, 50 years old.
Yeah, but this is a general theme. Groupthink will not lead to innovation, of course. And yeah, but I think these features contribute to that adaptive designs are perceived not to be used too often. On the other hand, if you count group sequential designs as adaptive, I mean, in many therapeutic areas, group sequential designs, they are absolutely standard by now. And the other aspect is maybe we overestimate, or sometimes we exaggerate the opportunity to run an adaptive design, because maybe your treatment is clear. You don't have to pick between two. Your population is clear. You don't have to enrich. There is no need for adaptation. I think we should also not think about this as that it will fit for every drug development question that we have. It's just a subset of drug development questions. And granted, if we would apply it whenever we have such an opportunity, it would still be much more. I think another thing is that as a drug developer and as a statistician in drug development, it takes a little bit of experience to spot these opportunities. And sometimes I feel statisticians should be a bit better trained to spot these opportunities in team discussions. When a team is struggling to define the dose at some point, then as a statistician, you should raise your hand and say, hey, we can put everything in the pivotal trial. And sometimes I feel you have to have seen a few development programs already. You have to be a bit senior to potentially spot these opportunities, and then at the same time also pull them off, have the technical background, or at least have the support that you can implement that in a way that is foolproof for regulatory purposes. Maybe that's another aspect that contributes to them not being used so often.
Yeah, I think for most of those listening here will be statisticians. And if you don't feel like you're an expert in that area, maybe just have a couple of discussions throughout the development of the study outline, whether that is something to consider or whether you should go with, let's say, a straightforward solution.
Or, one other aspect I think gains a little bit in importance also on a regulatory side, and something that maybe even we as statisticians are sometimes underappreciating a little bit. Assume you plan an adaptive trial. Of course, you plan that around the primary endpoint, say it's overall survival in oncology. But then you have a whole bunch of secondary endpoints. First of all, the inference for the primary endpoint may need to be adjusted. So the fact that you adapt doesn't just affect your type 1 error, it also affects your inference. If you want an unbiased estimate, you might need to account for the fact that you adapted. That's one aspect. And the other aspect is, I mean, in theory, you would have to pull through the adaptation for all secondary endpoints, for all safety endpoints, et cetera, et cetera. So from a conduct perspective and from an inference perspective, there might also be challenges. And yeah, if you take all this together, these are quite a few things that might lead that in certain instances, people just prefer a template thing that takes 1 year longer. Yeah.
However, if we think about how important just a couple of months are in terms of development time, and what we all do in terms of cutting time, time is really precious. So I think having a discussion about this is super helpful. One last thing before we go to the regulatory topic is futility analysis. Do you consider that to be an adaptive feature as well?
I think it depends on how you define a confirmatory adaptive trial. Often people say it is something where you adapt under type 1 error protection. A futility analysis typically doesn't affect your type 1 error. So do you call that adaptive, yes or no? For me, it somehow belongs, because futility analysis is the flip side of a group sequential design. So I would also summarize that in this family, because at the interim, you pick one of two scenarios. Either you set the sample size to zero, you kill the drug, or you run it to the end as planned. So for me, that's also an adaptation. I would count futilities also under adaptive designs. And building the bridge to what you just mentioned, the 20, there is also a short statement about futilities in E20. So I think that group also considers them to belong.
Yeah. So ICH E20, what is that all about?
ICH is the International Conference for Harmonization. That is a global consortium. It members from pharma industry and regulatory agencies that has built over the last, 50 years, a comprehensive suite of guidances that regulate or display good practice in drug development. And the one that is relevant for our audience statisticians is which describes good statistical principles for running clinical trials. And we have all talked a lot about R1, which can making a few things in E9 a bit more precise with respect to estimates. And it was felt that maybe it would be useful to write a guidance specifically on adaptive designs, and that's E20. And this working group has worked a couple of years now. I think it was a little bit hit by the pandemic because this working group, which brings together industry and regulatory statisticians, often meet face-to-face. The pandemic has postponed a few of those meetings, so it took quite a while until this draft guidance is now out, and it has been published about a month ago and is now open for comments from anybody who would like to make comments. And the title is indeed Adaptive Designs for Clinical Trials. So it's exactly discussing this very topic that we talk about today.
Yeah, and if you are relatively unfamiliar with the topic, I highly recommend you have a look into it and read through it. Thanks so much, Caspar, for another very useful episode. And I'm pretty sure this wasn't our last gig that we did together. We will both be at the Aspire Regulatory Workshop. And that happens in Basel. And you can join both in person and virtually. I will join in person because I think it's a huge opportunity also from a networking perspective. High value from a content perspective. There's lots of very interesting topics about it. If you want to meet up with one of us, then that is definitely one of the next spots to meet. The other opportunity is probably for you, ISCB, isn't it?
Yes, at the end of August, the International Society of Clinical Biostatistics holds their yearly conference in Basel as well. We expect about between 800 and 900 attendees. So the conference is completely sold out, and expect there also very pertinent program for statisticians working in industry. It's a bit more academically leaning. It's a different style than the ESPY workshop. And yeah, if you want the full coverage, then I invite you to attend both. The ESPY workshop is just 2 weeks later. And us talking about confirmatory clinical trials and E20, at the ESPY workshop, there will be a session about E20. So an industry view on E20 and the regulatory view on E20 and the panel discussion, where I anticipate some of the points that will come up in the commenting process will already be discussed. If you're interested in this topic, this might be really worthwhile to either to attend face-to-face or virtually and participate or contribute to the discussion.
Thanks so much. Have a great time.
Thank you, Alexander. Talk to you soon.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.